From Iowa to Maine, Louisiana to Ohio, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, Elon Musk has won his battle to take control of Twitter, giving rise to hopes the platform might actually become a forum for free speech. Jessica Malugan from the Competitive Enterprise Institute joins us for a discussion. The Federal Reserve Board of Governors has a new vice chairperson, and she brings a record of left-wing policy activism to the nation's central bank. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. Should the public policy actions of health officials be out of the reach of court review? Anthony Fauci thinks so, and Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine explains why he is wrong. And Democrats blocked reparations for slavery after the Civil War, but now use the issue for political gain. So says Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA on this week's American Radio Journal Commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. It now appears that Elon Musk has won his fight to gain control of the social media platform Twitter. Twitter has come under fire for suppressing free speech and enforcing a woke agenda. Will that now change? To find out, we talk with Jessica Malugan. She is director of the Center for Technology and Innovation at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Jessica, welcome to American Radio Journal. Jessica, Elon Musk taking over Twitter. Want to give us a little bit of background as to what has occurred here and what taking over actually means?
What's happened, Elon Musk was sort of outspoken critic of how Twitter has been moderating content, not from the beginning, but certainly in the last couple of years. They've really stepped up their enforcement for a number of different reasons. Some critics say it's politically driven, which is certainly possible, but also more of a bottom line explanation for that is that Twitter wants to make money, and how its business model lets that happen is advertising. And if you consider that the Mercedes car dealership probably doesn't want their ad popping up next to violent material or anti-Semitic content, some of this content moderation, taking things down that are offensive to lots of people, is about their bottom line, right? They want advertisers to spend their money on Twitter as opposed to the other sites where they could advertise. And Elon Musk has been one of the users that said they've gone too far in that direction, that it's not really a free speech viewing space like it used to be at the beginning. So not only is he a very frequent user of Twitter, he tweets multiple times a day, but he's also been a critic of that. And then a couple of weeks ago, we started to hear rumblings. He posted a poll saying, do you think that Twitter is a free speech environment? And he kind of hinted that maybe he was going to start his own social media platform. But as things have turned out, apparently he decided that for someone who's the world's richest man, it's a lot easier to just buy one that's already there and make it what you want it to be. So that's what we're in the midst of. You know, he was able to raise this money and he's taking the company private, and that was approved by the Twitter board. And now we're sort of watching the social reaction to that, the political consequences of that play out here in real time.
The left, of course, is in meltdown over this because Twitter and Facebook and other platforms certainly have tilted left. And talk a little bit more, Jessica, about the fact that those of us on the right side of the spectrum, conservatives, have felt that free speech is something that has been curtailed by all of these platforms. Is this something that we might be able to look forward to Twitter being more of a free and open public expression platform going forward?
I think it's certainly a possibility. That's what Mr. Musk has indicated he wants to have happen on Twitter. I think that, you know, the details of how that will work and what he'll keep getting rid of and what he'll allow to stay up that Twitter wouldn't have normally are unclear. Content moderation is very difficult. There's a lot more gray area than the couple examples we all have, I think, on the right, where you do sort of the mind boggles about why this could be taken down. I think there's some legitimate concerns there from the right, but there's also a lot of this stuff that, frankly, no one in their right minds would want to see. You know, no one's looking for content of beheadings and violence. And then there's the gray area where one person's, you know, healthy skepticism about the CDC or the government's role in something is another person's misinformation. That's where the wicket gets sticky. So we'll see how he navigates all that. But if he can find a way to do a better job of at least leaving sort of the political stuff up, more of it than would have been, I think that the right of America will probably benefit from that.
The other alternative here to having someone like Elon Musk purchase this platform, Jessica, is that there could be government regulation of it. Do you see this as a better way to go, a better route to take?
I sure do. I mean, we can talk really briefly about some of the problems with the solutions proffered by the government left and the government right. But I will just say the thing that's beneficial about a private solution as compared to both those sets of ideas is that it's contained to Twitter. If Elon Musk makes this decision and it's a great decision he just hits it out of the park with the content moderation, that's something that Facebook and Parler, they can all take from that and learn from that and perhaps follow in his footsteps, and that's great. If he blows it and it's a disaster, then those bad consequences for social media users are confined, right? It's not the top-down government regulation where if our legislators make a mistake with that, which is very possible. This is complicated, hard stuff. It's not everywhere all the time. And then the second half of that, of course, is that Elon Musk can change his policies that day. He can say, oh, I tried this. It didn't work. I don't like it. I'm going to tweak it. I'm going to improve it. I'm going to repeal it. And that happens instantaneously. Such is not the case for bad government regulations, especially when you're dealing with something like speech, right? It has to go through the whole legislative process to be changed or repealed. And that's by design, right? We want our government to grind along slowly. But again, those processes weren't designed with regulating such a dynamic industry in mind, right? Which probably is the indication that they should stay out of it and let people like Elon Musk and all the users of all these social media platforms vote with their thumbs, as I say, and their eyeballs, and they go where they like the rules that are in place. And that the people running these platforms respond to that, that's a much quicker mechanism for getting us to consumer satisfaction than a bunch of people who I suspect don't answer their own emails that are serving in Congress. I really don't want them in charge of how my social media works.
The other platform that has come under a lot of criticism and scrutiny is Facebook. So a little bit of a crystal ball question here, Jessica. Is this takeover of Twitter by Elon Musk something that the folks at Facebook might be looking over their shoulder a little bit?
Well, I sure hope they are. They're not doing very well in terms of growing their user base. They're losing users, and the median age of their users is probably getting a little older than they'd like it to be. They're going to have to start thinking about making some changes and innovating. I think that this, anytime you can put pressure on a leader and a market player to do better and do more, it's a good thing. And I think no matter what Elon does, just that he's entering the space and shaking it up, it's probably that pressure for Facebook.
We have been talking with Jessica Malugin, who is director of the Center for Technology and Innovation at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Jessica, tell us a bit about CEI.
At CEI, we are a free market anti-regulatory think tank. So we just work on economic issues, and our idea is to shrink the regulatory state and provide more space for liberty and economic freedom in the U.S. and globally.
And the website where folks can go to read your writings on this topic?
CEI.org.
Jessica Malugin of the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Jessica, thank you for being here.
My pleasure.
We turn now to the Club for Growth, where Scott Parkinson is standing by. Scott, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
We have a grab bag of issues to talk about today. We'll start with the Federal Reserve Board of Governors, which has a new vice chairman, someone that really wasn't a person we wanted to see there.
Yeah, this week the United States Senate confirmed Lael Brainard to be vice chairman of the Board of Governors at the Federal Reserve. And Club for Growth opposed that nomination. Look, we really think that the Board of Governors is expected to be comprised of nonpartisan, highly qualified individuals that ultimately lead the central bank in implementing America's monetary policy. But right now we're sort of dealing with this level of inflation that's certainly historic. And the Biden administration went ahead and rolled out a partisan radical to be the vice chair. Brainard's political activity surrounding the presidential campaign of Hillary Clinton, we think, is evidence of a quid pro quo and pay to play to receive a nomination to be chairman of the Federal Reserve as far back as 2016, and just 6 years later, President Biden is rewarding her partisan loyalty with this nomination. And on policy, Brainard's views and positions are pretty alarming. She's got this inability to embrace capitalism or even reject socialism, and she's also very much open-minded to using the Fed Reserve to promulgate new regulations related to global warming and the environment. We don't think that the Fed should have an environmental activist pushing Green New Deal policies. Instead, they should be focused firmly on these monetary policies that create and sustain and embrace economic freedom. We also think Brainard is just straight up wrong about inflation. She said that inflation right now that we're dealing with is transitory, but obviously this is an economic reaction to Joe Biden's policies that are pushing us closer and closer to an economic recession every day. And so for her to refuse to take inflation and the threat that that poses on the U.S. economy and jobs and really innovation, that jeopardizes our economic recovery following two pretty tough years of the coronavirus pandemic. The last thing I'd want to say is you've got these things called CBDCs, central bank digital currencies, and Brainard has been pushing for the United States to create a cryptocurrency digital dollar that would be backed by the central bank. This is just a bad idea, right? We want free markets to basically thrive. When you've got innovative cryptocurrencies leading the way for many new investors, just because China is developing a digital currency, they're already a communist nation. So Brainard's nomination was certainly very concerning. She was ultimately confirmed. And so going forward, we're going to try to really hold the Federal Reserve to its charter, ensuring that it focuses on monetary policy and not all these radical issues.
Let's take just a minute or so, Scott, and talk about the federal budget process. It is a process that really is never ending. Where are we in the annual calendar of activities that has to take place?
Typically, at this point in the year, you'd already have a budget resolution that would be passed. We did see President Biden's budgetary framework come late, but it was released several weeks ago. And what the United States Senate and the House of Representatives can do, they can proceed to regular appropriations in absence of a budget beginning in May. But in the meantime, we're seeing supplemental appropriation requests, whether it's dealing with the increased necessity to provide financial assistance to Ukraine, or else you've got the Democrats that are calling for more coronavirus money, if you can believe it or not. And so right now those supplemental requests are being formed and negotiated among the appropriators. I would expect to see a pretty significant supplemental appropriations request come through, and we'll see. Typically, Washington has a lot of bipartisan agreement on spending. And so if Joe Biden can corral enough political support for what's going on there, that will be the linchpin to sort of open up a new floodgate of federal spending. The other thing that should be pointed out is there's a negotiation that's ongoing about Joe Biden's border policies related to Title 42. Joe Biden wants to allow that to lapse, and so that would actually exacerbate the issues on our border. This week we had a Texas National Guardsman that drowned while trying to save two illegal immigrants that were crossing the Rio Grande. And so border security, once again, right back in the middle of the news, and that could also play into the way that these supplemental appropriations are constructed.
The president is going to be attending a number of high-profile events over the coming week or so, Scott, and we already have the vice president, Kamala Harris, tested positive for COVID-19 this past week. All these events the president is taking, is that a bit of a risk for especially someone who is older and somewhat frail to be out in all these public events?
Well, obviously he's been boosted and vaccinated, but that doesn't stop you from getting the coronavirus, right? We see the same thing with Kamala Harris, and she's fairly healthy and young. So she's a little bit sidelined this week. Additionally, Biden has commitments to attend the funeral for Madeleine Albright, and then also there's a service later for Walter Mondale out in Minnesota. And then this weekend, he's attending the White House Correspondents Association dinner. and that has over 2,500 people there. We learned this week that Anthony Fauci was actually canceling his own plans to attend over his concerns of the coronavirus outbreak, so-called outbreak, that's happening in the D.C. area. But the good news is that, you know, we obviously had a federal judge strike down the masking mandates in public transportation. No longer do you need to wear a mask on an airplane or on the bus or on the metro. And, you know, I'm kind of moving around Washington, D.C., and I'll tell you, this was the first week that I actually got stuck in traffic, really, in 2 years.
Well, certainly the country is moving past it. Anthony Fauci, of course, this past week said that the United States is out of the pandemic phase, although the world is not. Let's hope we continue moving in that direction. We have been talking with Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth. And Scott, a few words about the club.
Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington. Check us out. Our website's clubforgrowth.org. We hope you'll join to become a member for free.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, talk with you again next week. Thank you.
Thank you.
Anthony Fauci thinks the actions of the Centers for Disease Control know best and therefore should not be subject to judicial review. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine disagrees and tells us why.
Dr. Anthony Fauci says he is surprised and disappointed with last week's federal court ruling that overturned the federal mask mandate on planes, trains, and public transportation, and that's not because the president's chief medical advisor disagrees with the substance of that ruling. No. What Fauci told CNN last week is that he thinks the problem is that courts have any power over public health at all. And that's, frankly, a pretty anti-democratic attitude. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. No guest for me this week. Instead, we're taking a closer look at some of these remarks that Dr. Anthony Fauci made in the wake of last week's federal court ruling, a ruling made by Judge Catherine Kimball Mizell of Florida that overturned that federal mask mandate on planes, trains, and public transportation. I think a victory for anybody who's had to fly or take a subway, as I often do, on a regular basis. And Dr. Fauci responded to that decision, again, not by criticizing the merits of it or by, and in fact, this goes beyond Fauci to many other critics of that ruling, didn't debate the merits of the ruling or why the judge may have viewed the case the way she did, but rather by arguing that courts simply shouldn't have any authority over public health in the first place, that this shouldn't be a court issue. And I'm not exaggerating. That's exactly what Dr. Fauci told CNN's Casey Hunt Thursday a week ago. Here's what he said.
Because those types of things really are the purview of the CDC. This is a public health issue. And for a court to come in, and if you look at the rationale for that, it really is not particularly firm. And we are concerned about that, about courts getting involved in things that are unequivocally public health decisions. I mean, this is a CDC issue. It should not have been a court issue.
Now, considering how much of his life has been spent working within or alongside the federal government, Dr. Anthony Fauci's belief that the CDC ought to exist outside of the constitutional limitations applied to government actions is, frankly, pretty stunning. This is either a complete misunderstanding of the American system's basic functions or an expression of disdain towards the very rule of law that is at the foundation of it. Fauci says that the CDC had a perfectly logical plan to review the mask mandate in early May, as it intended to do prior to this week's ruling that scrapped it. But he went on to say that the court effectively came in and interfered in what should be left up to public health authorities to decide. Here's more from Fauci.
It was perfectly logical for the CDC to say, wait a minute, we were planning on ending this mandate on a certain date. Let's wait a period of time until May 3rd, which was a very sound public health decision. So for a court to come in and interfere in that is really unfortunate. It's unfortunate because it's against public health principles, number one. And number two is because that's no place for the courts to do that. This is a CDC decision, and that's very bad precedent.
Now, here's the thing. Even if a mandate is a good idea, even if it is logical, that doesn't mean that it falls within the legal authority of the agency that imposed it. In fact, that's exactly why a co-equal branch of government is tasked with determining whether the actions of the other two branches are legal. This is the fundamental reason why we have a judicial system in the first place, why it's part of the Constitution. Or as Judge Mizell put it in her ruling, quote, "Our system does not permit agencies to act unlawfully, even in pursuit of desirable ends." That's exactly right. The COVID-19 pandemic has taught us that many public health officials don't seem to recognize the limits of their powers or the importance of the rule of law. Fauci has previously criticized other foundational aspects of the American political system, such as state officials' ability to set their own rules, regardless of what the federal government might say. That's just another way of expressing the same opinion that Fauci shared last week with CNN, that the CDC's edicts ought to be absolute. This sentiment, of course, extends beyond just Fauci. As I wrote in a February feature for Reason Magazine, we've seen that in state after state, public health officials have lined up to defend arbitrary and aggressive pandemic rulemaking against the constraints of the democratic process. In situations when legislatures have revolted against executive branch edicts, public health officials have pretty much unilaterally lined up behind those edicts. They've defended both Republican and Democratic administrations, showing a bias towards power rather than towards any particular political party. And of course, it's not just public health officials who have this view. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki told reporters this week that public health decisions shouldn't be made by the courts. They should be made by public health experts. Legal commentators, including Slate's Mark Joseph Stern, have similarly collapsed the distinction between what may be sensible and what may be legal. If the CDC or state public health agencies require the legal authority to mandate masks and other pandemic-related behaviors, then they should ask Congress or their state lawmakers to explicitly grant those powers via legislation. Come on, it's been 2 years. There's been plenty of time for that to happen. We don't need emergency orders and public health guidelines without any basis in the rule of law. But there's never been a serious attempt to do such a thing, to legitimize these rules via the democratic process, via the political process. The CDC has merely claimed powers it never had, and then its defenders have whined about the inevitable backlash against that overreach. This is the same process that played out with the CDC's unlawful order banning evictions and the Biden administration's ill-fated attempt to have the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, that's OSHA, impose a vaccine mandate on private businesses. The outcome is the same here as it was in those two cases. Not getting your way in court is not grounds for discarding the very concept of the rule of law, and neither, for that matter, is a once-in-a-generation pandemic. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. You can check out more of our coverage of the coronavirus pandemic, the CDC, and everything else going on around the country this week at Reason.com, and catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Reparations for slavery made sense immediately following the Civil War, but were blocked by Democratic President Andrew Johnson. There being no living slaves or slaveholders today, the issue has become purely political, as explained by Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA on this American Radio Journal commentary.
Although the Russian war on Ukraine remains the top political and governmental issue in the country, we must not lose sight of other issues that have the potential to affect us in fundamental ways. In the roughly 6 months before the 2022 election, and the 2.5 years before the 2024 elections. One of those issues that has the potential to captivate the national attention and possibly further divide our already deeply divided nation is the issue of reparations for slavery. Let me state at the outset of this commentary that the chattel slavery that was legal in this country in the 18th and 19th centuries was utterly and unambiguously reprehensible and left an indelible moral stain on our national character that endures to this day. It was, however, legal for nearly 150 years. Since our national government did not condemn slavery until 1865, it is not unreasonable to assert that it should provide some kind of government-funded compensation to those who were its victims. President Abraham Lincoln supported a plan originated by General William Tecumseh Sherman in a field order that granted up to 40 acres of land to each emancipated slave family, later modified to include a mule. Sherman's field order was subsequently approved by President Lincoln, and it became what we call today an executive order. The plan was crudely designed and flawed in several respects, but in its conceptual basis, it was laudable. 40 acres and a mule would be provided by the government that had tolerated chattel slavery. Freed blacks would not have been included, only formerly enslaved blacks in the Confederate States. That reparations plan could have worked, although it would have been challenging to administer. But soon after Lincoln's assassination, his successor, Andrew Johnson, a Democrat, overturned the order and returned the land to the very people who had declared war on the United States of America. Many people do not know that the villainous Andrew Johnson, vice president to Abraham Lincoln, was a Democrat. In the more than 150 years since 40 acres and a mule was repealed as national policy, much has occurred that has had the effect of making it totally impossible to effectuate justice through reparations. Should a 21st century American black who is only 1/64th part descended from a slave receive the same compensation as one who is 100% descended from slaves? Should the blood of potential recipients be tested and their award be made proportionate to their African origin DNA? After having rejected the implicit dehumanization of counting blacks as only 3/5 of whites in congressional representation, how morally repugnant would it be to begin defining candidates for reparations into much smaller fractions based on their ancestry? Should the land offered to each family be diluted in size to reflect the growth in the black population since 1865? And what about singles? While it might have been possible to declare that some land in formerly Confederate states should be appropriated from the rebels and become federal government property to be given to former slaves, it's obviously impossible to do that now. Should it be taken from the national parks and other federal land? The acreage was originally to be tillable or capable of producing crops. What's the 21st century analog to tillable land? Should those 21st century African Americans whose ancestors came to the United States after 1865 be excluded? Making such arbitrary distinctions fairly is inherently impossible. And because some value would be attached to whatever was given, the divisive impact on our already divided nation would be devastating. In 1865, the presidential proponent of reparations for slavery was a Republican, and the presidential opponent of reparations for slavery was a Democrat. In 2022, the proponent of reparations are largely Democrats, and those who oppose reparations are largely Republicans. Today's Democrats know that reparations for the acts and policies of 150 years ago are inherently unworkable today, but they still propose them because they know that principled opposition can be exploited as racism, which should accrue to the political benefit of Democrats. That kind of perversion of reality borders on treason. The drive for reparations in this century must be stopped before it becomes a legitimate public policy debate, or it will further tear our nation apart, perhaps irreparably. This has been Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring for American Radio Journal.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including our newest affiliate, KSDZ-FM in Gordon, Nebraska. Welcome to our new listeners in the Cornhusker State. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.